Welcome to Our House, the only complete on-air resource for your home ownership needs. Now, here's the host of Our House, Peter Hunt.
Good morning and welcome to Our House. This is Peter Hunt, and the show is brought to you by the ever-improving HuntRealEstate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and home ownership experience. HuntRealEstate.com is powered by Hunt Real Estate ERE here in Buffalo, Niagara, all across upstate, and even through our links to Phoenix, Arizona, and Boston, Massachusetts. The show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage, NMLS number 37405. Hunt Mortgage is an equal opportunity lender. Call Hunt Mortgage today at 633-3700 and ask one of our skilled mortgage consultants to work with you to find the lowest rate and closing costs for your particular home financing needs, and that's always our our guarantee to you. Also ask about our many exclusive programs, including our pre-purchase commitment, one of our most popular programs ever that allows you at no cost or risk to effectively enter the market to find your next home with cash. And given today's very competitive listing inventory shortage market, it's most important that if you're interested in a home, that your offer is as strong as possible, particularly if there's competing offers. From a seller's perspective, the most attractive offer usually says cash. But the equivalent of that, and a skilled sales professional can articulate this to a seller, is our pre-purchase commitment. So call today, 633-3700, and you'll receive what we guarantee, also personalized, customized service that will knock your socks off. And don't forget about the first ever 24/7 365 real estate hotline, the Hunt Hotline, which gives you access to all available information about any property, not just our listings, any property that's listed for sale in any of the markets we serve. The local number here in Buffalo is 716-631-4800. When you dial that, enter the street number of the house you want to know about, no matter whose listing it is, and the hotline will prompt you with a choice of street names. Select the one you want. You'll hear a brief description, and then you'll be texted a link to a dedicated website. On that property, it's all automatic and just that fast anytime in any market we serve on any listing, whether it's ours or any of the brokers. Hunt is the official real estate and relocation provider for the our hometown professional teams, the Buffalo Bills, the Buffalo Sabres, Rochester Americans, and we've got a new hometown team, sort of, the Toronto Blue Jays, so, and the Bisons, of course, when they're able to play, too. We support all of them. We are broadcast live here on WBEN 930 AM, and if you'd like to reach us here in the studio to ask a question live on the air, you can call us at 803-0930 or 1-800-616-9236 if you're long distance. And star 930 for mobile. Those are all free calls. If you'd like to text us, it's 803-0930. Text us here in the studio, and we'll get to your question. And we have a very special show for you today. Live remote, respecting social distance, is the president of the Buffalo Niagara Partnership, Dottie Gallagher. Good morning, Dottie.
Good morning, Peter.
It's good to have you back.
It's great to be back, although I wish we were more than, this is a lot more than 6 feet. It's whatever, a few miles away.
Yeah, it's always better to have you in the studio. There's the interaction, which I really enjoy. You know, I was pulling out my file for this, for my Dottie Gallagher file, and it's by far my thickest file of all my radio guests. I think you've been on more times than just about anybody else on the planet, but I appreciate your willingness to share your thoughts with us. Take us back, Dottie, if you would. You were on in August, and at that point we were sort of open here in Western New York. People were out and about. And then, of course, November rolls around and we get shut down again pretty much. Tell us how the agenda, first of all, go back and tell us a little bit about the partnership itself and where you are today. And tell us how that agenda for the partnership changed over the course of the year given the circumstances around us.
Yeah, I mean, so your listeners who don't know, the partner is really the Regional Chamber of Commerce and Economic Development Organization. We're privately funded by employers, both for-profit and not-for-profit. And our job is to help businesses grow and create jobs and opportunity here in Western New York, and the private sector voice at all these government tables. So that's that, and all the information about us is on our website at thepartnership.org. So thank you, Peter, for that question. It's hard to ascertain when you say you go back to last August, where were we last August, where were we last March. The world is just a completely different place now from a work point of view. And our work is completely different than it was because, no live events, which is what we do, many, many live events during a year. So we had to do a complete pivot, and our goal was to be as responsive as we could be to employers that were trying to figure out in the beginning, you know, am I essential or non-essential? How do I shut down? How do I go back to work and all of that? And I don't know, I think we've done about 40 pandemic-related webinars with, you know, we've got members that have a deep expertise, you know, lawyers, accountants, you know, just consulting professionals that were really willing to share with the community at large. And we brought down the membership sort of gate so anybody could hear and see and be a part of all of this programming. And so where we are now is I feel like things have settled to some degree. The businesses that are essential and in certain sectors are really coming back. We still see in all the tourism, hospitality related sectors, and we hear a lot about this on the news, that is still really challenged right now. Although, you know, I'm happy Shays is going to be open this fall. There, you know, that's exciting. And it's been a real challenge to the economy. You know, we still have a lot of challenges to where we are. But when you look at the businesses that are doing, I'm going to say, well, manufacturing is a good example. They still have constraints around full recovery, around workforce issues, you know, getting people for the jobs that they have open, and quite honestly, still having a lot of supply chain issues, getting, you know, anybody who's ordered an appliance or, you know, any sort of anything that requires lots of parts from around the world, those businesses are still very challenged. So, you know, we're not there yet, but I definitely feel like we're on the road to recovery. And I think vaccines, you know, in my mind, vaccines are the key to really getting past this.
How in your discussions with your members, how do they see and how do you see the evolution of the workplace itself?
Well, you know, I think we're hearing things sort of all over the board. We've got members who have essential workers that have been open the entire time. And they kind of don't understand what's the big deal, like get everyone back to work, right? I mean, what they've been constrained about has been sort of the state guidance around how much of their workforce can return. So there are some people that are like, just let's get back to work. But what we hear most is that workers are really wanting, of all kinds, who can work remotely, don't want to, for the most part, go back full time. You know, they want some sort of hybrid you know, remote and in-person work. So I'll tell you, at the partnership, we're struggling with this in our own organization right now. Like, how do we go back? What's the right way to go back? And so I think it's still all over the board, Peter. I know that the big employers, banks, et cetera, are putting together plans, and most have said, you know, really, I think for the summer are going to be primarily remote, but I think whatever plans they're going to have will be in place by the fall.
In addition to workers liking being at home, I guess, for some anyway, we're seeing a big mixed bag on that. We're seeing a lot of people saying, you know, I'm done with being at home.
Yeah.
You know, I want to go to work. I want to see my coworkers. I want to have those. In one of our past conversations, we talked about the concept of collisions, where you just bump into somebody, not
right,
physically necessarily, but, hey, Dottie, what's going on? What are you working on? And all of a sudden, an idea evolves out of that. And that's, you know, you can Zoom all day, but that kind of thing won't happen. It just won't happen. And I just wonder what happens to productivity when we're so physically far apart.
Yeah, you know, this is a really interesting conversation about, because I think I've been thinking a lot about this. My own personal productivity is through the roof, right? Because I feel like I can, these meetings that I've had to attend, like, you know, I'm on the IDA board and various meetings like that used to eat up big chunks of my day. Now I just hop on a Zoom call and I can participate and then go back to whatever I was doing. So I feel like my personal productivity has gone through the roof. But your point of the culture of a workplace and why someone wants to work with people. At the partnership, we went full remote, and it worked flawlessly, and we have had a fantastic experience. But guess what? Now we're hiring new people, right? Because we had some open positions we didn't fill. We had some people leave, and we did eliminate a couple positions during the pandemic. And now we're rebuilding the organization. And we're really faced with this challenge of how do you build the kind of trust culture that allows those conversations to happen, right? When you don't know the people, they don't know you. You're just you're square on a Zoom box. So that's really, I think that's a big challenge of how do you create company culture? And that's what I mean about, I don't believe that we'll ever go to full remote work Some companies have to for whatever reason they have, but I think this need, your point, the accidental collisions, building trust, creating a culture of a place you want to work, that requires interpersonal interaction. So that's the balance I think people are trying to figure out, how you make that happen.
You know, you mentioned that some employers are already, you know, they brought their people back as fast as they could. We did that, for example. We were shut down, like everybody was, at the beginning of this, way back last March. But as soon as we got the rules of the game, and as soon as we were able to implement the physical changes in our offices, we opened as fast as we could. But we didn't say you had to come back. We said, well, the office is open, we want you back, but only come back as you feel comfortable. Some of our employees that we considered essential, we said, you know, your workplace is where you should be. But, for example, our mortgage company, which we recently moved downtown into the Brisbane building, and we expanded our commercial business as well there, we still are in a position where a lot of our people are working remotely, and we've given them that choice. But we're seeing more and more of our people want to come back. The cultural thing that you're talking about, that you just can't get through Zoom. But you made a very good point about the board meetings and the kind of the regularly scheduled meetings on our calendar that you have to drive 20 minutes to and then 20 minutes back, and then there's the gossip before and after, and then there's a lot of time wasted there that's no longer wasted. And I think that's going to go on indefinitely.
Gosh, I hope so. But, you know, we have had the same thing with our offices. Our offices, as soon as we were able to bring people back, we said, if you want to work in the office, you can work in the office. Just we just have to coordinate, right? You got to talk and let us know who's going to be there. But what's happening now, Peter, in the sense of you're saying more people want to come back to work, I do think that vaccines are responsible for a lot of that. I think the fear that people had about going back to work is really subsiding. Right. That in the beginning was, I'm afraid to go into the, mm-hmm. I'm afraid to, you know, be in front of other people. I think that's going away. I think what we're seeing evolve now is, you know, I like my life or I don't like my life the way it is right now, you know. And so that's what employers are really wrestling with, because it's a very competitive landscape right now for talent. And so employers don't want to lose people unnecessarily, but they also are struggling with sort of the fairness. Like, how do you make a policy that really is equitable for all your employees? And that's you just brought up a point. It depends on what your job is, and are you public facing, and can you do your job in a way that's remote? But we are hearing already, particularly from larger employers, like they're dreading this because, you know, if someone wants to work remote and their job allows them to work remote, and they want to come up with a policy that says that's okay, you only need to come in whatever, one day a week, the person who's got to be there 5 days a week is going to resent that, right? So how does this all work together, you know, in a way that doesn't create chaos in a workplace? And no one's got the answer because we've never been through this before.
Ideally, though, we should be using, and I think many businesses have, using this time to build in the efficiencies that we've been thinking about for a long time. And, for example, our title agency, excuse me, we were able to go completely digital, and we were the first agency in town to continue with closings pretty much as usual, all remote, all digital. And this is something that I think we all anticipated, but the pandemic allowed fast forward to happen. And I think a lot of businesses saw that too. How can we become more efficient? I talked to a friend of mine who runs a large business locally, and he told me that they carved so much expense out, they became so much more efficient, and their productivity went soaring, and their revenues went soaring too. So there's I think a lot of good that happened as a result of this from an industrial standpoint, just because people had to rethink how we operate. It wasn't just the same thing every day. All of a sudden, all the circumstances were changed.
Well, you know, and when there's when technology can enable that kind of change, a lot of people who are sort of technologically adverse, let's say, you know, or don't like change, resist it, right? So it's hard to sort of get to that. But what the pandemic did was it forced it, you know, you had to learn these skills. You had to learn how to do a remote meeting. You had to learn how to use digital files, right? And so we had SharePoint. We had Teams before the pandemic, but very few people used it. We still had people keeping files on their native computers and not making them shareable and still sending copies instead of sharing documents. Now it's second nature, right? So you're absolutely right. These things, businesses don't even have to think about it. It's happened, and they're not going to go backwards. It's like saying, okay, let's go back and use a fax machine. No, that's never going to happen. So, you know, I think you're absolutely right. I think there's been a lot of really positive efficiencies that have been gathered as using technology. I personally can't believe how much less paper I use. I mean, it sounds so silly. You know, just your habit of printing something out, right, to write on it. Now I would, you know, now I think, oh, I don't want to waste a piece of paper. I can do it on my screen. So, you know, it is interesting. I think that this pandemic has accelerated what was coming, but took away all that resistance because there was only one way to do it, and that was remote. So,
and I think what you're talking about is really the top end of the spectrum of work, workers. There's the other end of the spectrum, which I think has been devastated by this whole set of events. And one of the initiatives of the partnership was a fairly expansive workforce development program. Yeah. What happened to that?
We're still at it. And as a matter of fact, we're just in the process of planning to update our website with everything that we're doing. But you're so right, Peter, about what you're saying about the other end of the spectrum and getting people into jobs with true economic mobility. And I will say one thing the pandemic has done is in many of these service industry jobs where you can have machines do the work, just what we just talked about, that's happening at those lower level jobs as well. So there aren't as many of those jobs when we come out of the pandemic as there were before. So what happens to those people, and how do we get more people in the workforce into these key jobs that we are going to have open? So we were working on something we call talent pipeline management, which is where we're working with groups of employers around sort of removing the barriers to work and really cultivating the talent pipelines that they needed. When the pandemic hit, we all went into sort of survival mode, right? So that work sort of, that's long tail work. You know, it takes 18 to 24 months to sort of assemble that talent pipeline and work with the education training providers and market it. And so that's sort of, you know, that employers were not willing to even think about that. They were just really figuring how to survive the pandemic. But we're back at that. There's a real appetite. So that work has resumed. We are also, we haven't launched it yet, but we have a working prototype we're in partnership with the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta to do something called, what we're calling the Benefits Cliff Calculator. So this gets to that other end of the spectrum we're talking about, people who are in lower wage jobs, who can't or it is not economically feasible for them to work more hours or to take a better job because they lose too many benefits on the other side. Because people who are someone in our country working a minimum wage job really needs other support in order to live, you know, to live beyond the poverty line, right? They need food stamps, they need housing assistance, they need daycare help, daycare subsidies for so that they go to work. Well, the way that those government programs are set up, if you make $1 more, you lose 100% of that benefit, right? With the exception of housing, which does have in Erie County has a stepped down equivalent. So what happens is there's this cliff that says, okay, I can't take that other job or I can't work 10 more hours because I will lose too much money. And so that isn't what the government was intending to do with those benefits, right? And certainly not the life that most people want to be to live, because they're trapped there. They mm-hmm. never really will have enough money to buy a house, to get the things that they want, to pass down their generational wealth. And none of that is possible. They are stuck. They are trapped in that world. So to me, when you look at Buffalo's, and I always say Buffalo, you know, I don't mean this, just the city. I mean the region. When you look at this region, you look at the high rates of poverty in the city of Buffalo, in the city of Niagara Falls, and you look at all that workforce that's sitting there, all that talent that never gets tapped. We have to figure this out. How do we help these people cross the bridge to prosperity? So the Benefits Cliff Calculator will allow both an individual, an employer, and also our government partners to see, you know, I'm a single mom with two kids who are these ages. This is the career track that I'm interested in. What is it? Where does the cliff happen? And how can we begin to mitigate that cliff? And some of this mitigation can be done by the way employers fund transportation, as an example, or fund training. But some of it can't. And so that's where the partnership will really be stepping in and talking to government officials and New York State in particular about the structure of these programs that will allow people to not lose so much in order to move ahead. We all have an interest in this community because a part of the calculator shows you what the lifetime cost of those benefits are when a person opts out of taking that journey on better economic prosperity, what it costs us. And when you look at this calculator, Peter, and it is an amazing thing. It will be available for everyone to look at. There isn't a person on the planet that would make a different decision. It is a financial planning tool that any reasonable person would make the decision of that person who chooses not to cross that bridge to prosperity. So when you look at the lifetime cost and you look at the gaps, it is a really, truly a pay me now or pay me later sort of thing. So how can we invest in people, and how can we create a structure that allows people to move up and into more meaningful jobs that we desperately need? We desperately need that talent in our talent pool. So that's coming.
We definitely do, Dottie. We have to go to break right now. I want to come back to that point. You brought up several questions. We'll be right back with more from our house cheers with Dottie Geller after these important messages.
Downsizing from your current home? Love the idea of waterfront living? The West End, Buffalo's newest luxury townhome community, may be perfect for you. In the heart of the waterfront village, the West End offers picturesque Lake Erie views. Each three-bedroom unit is meticulously crafted with the highest quality materials and amenities. To view this landmark development from Simonelli Real Estate, schedule your private showing now with exclusive listing agent Deacon Tasker with Hunt Real Estate at 280-7787 or by visiting westendbuffalo.com.
Welcome back to our house. This is Peter Hunt, and this show is brought to you by the ever-improving HuntRealEstate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and homeownership experience. HuntRealEstate.com is the only place on the web where you can find a complete inventory of homes available here in Buffalo, Niagara, and all the markets we serve across upstate and through our links to Phoenix, Arizona, and Boston, Massachusetts. You'll also find access to a complete set of homeownership services at HuntRealEstate.com, which is powered by Hunt Real Estate ERA. The show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage, and for more information about our many exclusive programs, including our pre-purchase commitment, which I mentioned earlier, which is something everyone should take advantage of. It's free. There's no risk. And the other program that you have to take a look at, you're probably being bombarded by all kinds of media from various mortgage companies and banks telling you that just call us and we'll qualify you and give you a pre-approval, et cetera. That's fine, but you want to make sure that you're getting the best deal possible, and we'll make sure that you're getting the best deal through what we call our Second Look program, 633-3700. It's free. There's no obligation, and just by calling, we're going to give you a gift certificate. So call and check that out today, the Second Look program, only available at Hunt Mortgage. We're live remote this morning with Dottie Gallagher, the president of the Buffalo-Niagara Partnership, and we've been talking about, I think, probably the issues of the day, I think, Dottie, in terms of, you brought up the issue of generational wealth and how that gets started and how this, for example, this benefits calculator will help someone who's receiving benefits be able to, I'm assuming it helps them see where the threshold is, where they can and might be able to go back to work. Is that really the intent of it?
Well, What it looks at is if a person wants to choose, let's say someone is working, I'm going to make this up, they're working in hospitality, but they're considering a career in healthcare. They can go into the calculator and say, okay, if I choose this field, right, here's what the wages are going to be plotted over my lifetime, and those wages are based on real numbers, right? Mm-hmm. We pay here in this region, and their benefits will be plotted along there. And where there is a place where they make more money and it causes a loss of benefits, it's actually mapped out so they can actually physically see where that's going to happen. It's going to happen 5 years from now when my kid is out of high school or whatever the circumstances, they can see that. And then they can make they can make plans accordingly. They can also look at that and say, boy, you know what? That career track, if I'm planning on going to healthcare and all I'm going to do is be a CNA and I'm not going to become, an RN, I'm not any better off, right? So it really allows from an individual point of view to really see, is this, what's the upside for me to do this? And from a employer point of view, and there are employers you and I both know, Peter, that have people that are really talented. They want to move up in their organization, and their people are refusing to move up or take more hours or work overtime, right? And the employer doesn't understand why. So from an employer point of view, they're going to look at this and say, aha, now I see what the challenge is. And that will help employers decide, how can I pay a more competitive wage in certain jobs that are key in my organization, or how can I smooth this curve so that people don't lose as much? And transportation is a good example. So right now, if someone takes public transit, for example, the employer's not paying for transportation. Maybe they could. That's really no different than paying to maintain a parking lot, right, where we drive our cars. So things like that. And we're going to work with the employer side to help them figure it out. So it, depending on your vantage point, it's going to tell you, it's going to tell you what is the best thing for you to do. And I think in some cases, it's really for individuals, they're going to say, wow, I will be able to buy a house. I will be able to go on vacation. I will have all this discretionary income when I get to this point, if I go through this pain that I've got over here, that, the cost of training and all those things that happen on the front end of that cycle. So it just lays it bare and allows everyone to sort of look at it and say, what's best for me and what's best for my business?
To me, this is fascinating. I didn't know that existed. And how do you intend to promote this?
Well, actually, we're going to do a very deep campaign to all the groups, employers, training providers, and individuals. And actually, we've gotten word that we're going to have a grant to actually put together a really formal communications plan to get it out into the community. So right now, it's in prototype. The Federal Reserve is sort of making some other changes that we wanted to see to it. And we're thinking probably September is when it will be ready to sort of at least start to introduce in small audiences so that we can test the messaging and then get it out broadly. But it's going to be available on a website, whether our website or a website we stand up just to house this. We haven't quite figured that out yet. But the whole idea is to make it a tool that anybody can look at, use, and, for lack of a better definition, play with. And part of the career tracks that we're going to put in there are going to be in-demand jobs that we're trying to fill. And then, of course, tools that if you want to, get trained, let's say, in those in-demand jobs, how do I get started for that? So it's really a holistic approach to, Peter, this is really super hard work because, a lot of times we're treating the symptom and not the disease. And I really feel like this calculator is one important piece of really getting to the heart of the disease, of the structure of how we have we've kept people out of opportunity and in our communities. So we're super excited about it. And the Federal Reserve has done this in three other cities, but never really. It's always been from a workforce public sector lens, not the lens that we're taking, which is how do we help employers cultivate this talent. So what we're doing here is kind of exciting.
I think it's very exciting. And, I don't know if you saw the Wall Street Journal on Thursday, but the lead opinion article was called Killing the American Dream. And it talks about the government programs and how they're doing exactly the opposite, the ones that are proposed anyway, how they will do exactly the opposite in terms of encouraging people to develop their own means by which they become upwardly mobile as opposed to waiting for or just depending upon government programs. And this all relates to the yet-to-be-passed families plan that President Biden has put forward. And I'm sure you're aware of the fact that Jeffrey Gundlach did a extensive webinar through the Albright Knox Art Gallery, Albright Knox Gundlach Art Museum, I should say, a couple weeks ago, during which he painted a very dark picture of the effects of program upon program, expenditures upon expenditures that are unfunded, or are funded through basically only one means, which is to go after corporations and the wealthiest people in our society. This it's extremely disturbing to me when I see this happen, and where the incentive is really taken away from people to enter the workforce as you describe, or to seek training, or whatever the case might be. How are you planning in your model? Are you anticipating that these measures will be passed, and therefore there will be more incentives, perhaps not to go through the program you're describing?
Well, I think, I think part of this, Peter, is you have to watch the narrative with which we describe this. There isn't a person on the planet that does not want to feel accomplished and successful and to earn and to provide for their family, right? The question is, am I able to succeed, right? Is the circumstance around me? The issue of this is such a big issue, but when you think about this holistically, the government is trying to solve a problem by throwing money at it, right? And I will say that daycare, which is a big part of the Biden plan, is a real barrier for people to go to work, right? Who want to.
Of course, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so that part of it is good. But the issue of how do we empower people, instead of saying, these benefits have take away the incentive, listen, if you're in a situation where this is your life and this was your parents' life and you maybe didn't get the best education, you've suffered. I mean, black and brown people in our community have suffered structural racism their entire lives for generations, right? So they're not starting at the, they're not starting at the same point in terms of opportunity. And so what we really need to think about, in my mind, to make this work is how do you unleash the power of that talent? And, Say Yes Buffalo is a great, great first step in terms of really getting opportunity for people either to get higher ed or further training outside of school. But there is a huge issue here in that people are trapped in poverty. So it's not that they're incentivized to stay poor. It's that, I am too afraid that if I leave this, the only security I have in my life is I have this place to live, right? And I don't want to take a chance that I lose it, because then what happens to my family? So we have to really begin to think about it really from a human point of view. And, I think there are a lot of issues with the American Rescue Plan that are problematic in my mind, which we can talk about next. There's a lot of money that is going to be, without a lot of accountability, being thrown into our communities that may or may not be transformational, depending on how it gets spent. And this is a part of that. And I 100% agree that overtaxing the people who create jobs is a recipe for disaster, because that capital is mobile and that capital will leave the United States.
Not to mention there's just simply not enough of it. If they taxed all of it, it wouldn't.
It's silly. I think I understand what Biden is trying to do here. I don't mean to be political on this at all. I feel like we do need a huge, this is the time for government to help us get our economy back on track. I do agree with big spending and infrastructure, which this country desperately needs, and that can put people to work. The question is, in the American Rescue Plan, how is that money going to be spent responsibly by these, particularly by governments and schools? So, just to put it in perspective, the city of Buffalo had a budget gap of $65 million. They're getting $350 million from the federal government. County of Erie, same deal. Millions and millions of dollars. City of Niagara Falls, millions and millions of dollars. If how we spend that money is we hire a bunch more people for 3 years and then we have to lay them off, and I'm not saying anybody's doing that. I don't know what the government, what each of these government plans are yet. They're being developed, but they need to be investments that will pay dividends for the community in a transformational way.
Is the partnership at the table for these discussions of these plans?
Well, you know, we're trying to push ourselves there. You know, we're having conversations with elected officials around this issue, and we're trying to raise awareness around this issue, and not just here, not just the partnership, not just here in Buffalo, but really my counterparts across the country. So take that money. Just take the Buffalo number, for example, 65 to whatever, 350, I think it's 350 million. Take that proportionality and apply it to every municipality across this country, because that's what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
That's the level of infusion of cash that's coming into government. So, and by the way, when I say infusion of cash, I mean our money, right? I mean the money taxpayers are paying. That's the government's money is our money. So
it's borrowed money, Dottie.
It's borrowed money, but we're going to be paying for it, as I point, Peter, right?
Sooner or later, I hope.
It doesn't come from some God doesn't hand the government money. I mean, it comes from, you know, people who are earning wages. So what is the level of accountability around that? There's a tension between acting quickly, which I think the federal government in the previous administration, this administration, has been very responsive, you know, with the PPP loans and, you know, mm-hmm. and unemployment, which is now, of course, becoming a problem, the additional unemployment. But, you know, that's what we needed. And that is why we're in sort of, I think, a better position economically today than I thought we would be a year ago.
Donnie, we have to go to a break. I want you to hold that thought, and we're going to come back to it after these messages from our house to yours.
Downsizing from your current home? Love the idea of waterfront living? The West End, Buffalo's newest luxury townhome community, may be perfect for you. In the heart of the waterfront village, the West End offers picturesque Lake Erie views. Each three-bedroom unit is meticulously crafted with the highest quality materials and amenities. To view this landmark development from Simonelli Real Estate, schedule your private showing now with exclusive listing agent Deacon Tasker with Hunt Real Estate at 280-7787 or by visiting westendbuffalo.com.
Welcome back to our house. This is Peter Hunt, and the show is brought to you by the ever-improving HuntRealEstate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and homeownership experience. The show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage, NMLS number 37405, home of the low rate and closing cost guarantee, as well as the pre-purchase commitment and the second look program. Call them today, 633-3700. I'm live remote this morning with Dottie Gallagher, the president of the Buffalo Niagara Partnership, and we've been talking about really the kind of the what coming out of the pandemic, shutdown, recession, whatever you want to call it, and it was probably both of those things, what does the future look like? How will people be impacted? What the role of the government is? We're going all over the place, Dottie. But before we go any farther, I want to come back to the thought that we ended the last segment with. But we have a caller on the line from Rochester. This is John from Rochester. John, how can we help you?
Hey, Peter. Hey, Dottie. Dottie, before I get into my question, I want to just remind you, we don't have structural racism in this country. We've got structural civil rights. A lot of our cities are governed by people of color, Buffalo, Rochester, many, many cities in this country. This country is a great country. It's structural civil rights, not structural racism we have right now. Anyway, I want to get to my point. My question for you is this. We've got all these incentives throughout the country for different programs for people not to work, and this is causing a problem as far as supply of workers go. We've got illegal immigrants coming into the country, and do you see this as being a long-term problem when these incentives wear off and we've got extra people on low-income wages upsetting the supply and demand of workers, and what this is going to result in is lower wages? What are your thoughts?
Peter, want me to take that?
Yes, please.
Question. Okay, so you know, it's John. I appreciate your perspective and calling in. I think actually we're going to see, if you look at sort of the population trends, right? All these baby boomers, which I am at the tail end, are retiring, right? And the supply of workers is going to, I think, we were worried about that. I think through innovation, a lot of these lower-end jobs may disappear. And so the real question becomes, how do you reskill and upskill people for the jobs that are available? And as you point out, we need to get people into the workforce. And I do think that, right now it's $600 in addition to traditional unemployment, that if you spread that out, it's about $15 an hour not to work, right? Which, why would you go take a job for $15 an hour if you could stay home for $15 an hour. So I think naturally people will have to go back into the workforce when those benefits expire. And I can tell you a lot of our members are upset about it because they have jobs that they need to have filled and they can't find workers to fill them. So I don't think we're going to see a lowering of wages at all, because I think it's still going to be competitive to get workers for some time to come.
That begs the question, Dottie, of inflation. We hear from the Fed that there isn't inflation like anybody who walks into a store is seeing. So what do you think the truth is here, and how do you think the fact that we are seeing inflation? I mean, there is an argument out there that it's temporary. I've never seen that, and I think that's silly. But how do you see that? And then, just as you're saying, what will the impact be on wages?
Well, listen, full disclosure, I'm not an economist, right? So this is just my opinion, which, you know, you can is worth the $2 you'd pay at Tim Hortons for a cup of coffee. But, what I think we are going to see on the commodities that have the pricing has gone up. So take lumber as an example. You know, lumber, I happen to have two quotes on lumber, from one from last November was $80 a sheet, and now one last week is $125 a sheet. So, you know, you see that's just natural commodity pricing that is because of scarcity, right? Same thing's happening with aluminum and a few other of those things. So I think when that supply chain straightens out, those commodity prices will come down. You know, so that I think is that part of it is, quote, temporary. But look at what's happening in the grocery store and all that. I don't see those prices going backwards. But we haven't had any inflation for I don't know how long now, Peter, really, to speak of. So I don't think we're going to see a reduction in wages. Certainly that's not what employers are experiencing. They're having to pay people more. So I don't really know where it's all going to shake out. It is something we have to keep an eye on, but I have no idea. You have to get someone much smarter than me to answer that question.
If you didn't hear Jeffrey Gundlach, I'm going to send you a tape of that so you can see for yourself.
I'd love to see it. Thanks.
Because his work, the depth of his research is startling, really, and extremely comprehensive. And his pure brilliance in economics, which you said you don't have, and I certainly don't either, really is eye-opening. But it does address just these issues, and it relates to John's question because and he addresses that in his analysis, and I'll send that to you. But what really strikes me, I guess, at this stage of the game is, going back to where we started our conversation, if you were to look out over the next few months, what do you see happening in terms of the fundamental kind of concept of opening, and particularly as it relates to New York City and New York City's influence or lack thereof on what happens here in Buffalo?
Well, my personal opinion is the answer to that question is whether or not we achieve enough vaccinated population, right? Because ultimately, if we can't get to where we need to be, things will not be able to go back to where they were before. That's a fact. And I tell you what, the level of hesitancy we see in some communities makes me wonder if we will get there. We see a lot of creativity that's happening now, but, you know, we're at whatever, 45%, and, you know, we got to get to 75-80%, and you still have a lot of vaccine hesitancy. And people are still getting sick, and the people who are getting sick are getting very sick. So, there's nobody in an Erie County hospital that has gone through a complete course of vaccination. So I would make this appeal, if you really care about the economy, to do your research, and if you're vaccine hesitant, you know, get comfortable and get vaccinated. Because ultimately that's where it's at. And I think if we can't get to that level of herd immunity, I don't know how. I think whatever happens will be semi-permanent, right? Will we ever be able to stop wearing masks, as an example, if we're in closed spaces? I don't know. So that is job number one. And I can tell you, I'm spending a tremendous amount of time on vaccine education with employers, making sure that employers who are really important trust networks to help people get educated on the Q&As on vaccine safety and efficacy. There's a lot of misinformation out there. So That to me is the most important economic development job we have right now as a community is increasing the vaccination rate.
The other side of this, too, you did mention people still become ill. There's enormous work going on that really isn't talked about too much in the press because we're constantly focused on this vaccination thing. But the advances in therapeutics are pretty startling also. And as that happens, I think hopefully people no one wants to get sick. But if you do get sick, I think we're in a better, way better position we are, a year and 3 or 4 months post the introduction of this whole mess than we were way back then, just in terms of treating people.
The variants are, the issue is the variants, though, Peter, right? So yep. Will those treatments be as good with the variants or not? And that's to be told. So that's what we're in a race against that. We're in a race to sort of squelch this to get to herd immunity so that it can't keep mutating. That's really, that's where the big question mark is in my mind anyway.
Well, let's go back to today for just a second. We have several states around the country that are looking pretty normal right now. Their incidence of COVID-19 are no higher than ours are, yet their economies are doing far better than ours is in all through New York State. The way of life is much, closer to what we would call normal than we are here. How do you account for that huge discrepancy?
Well, again, I'm not a scientist, but I will say that in some of the economies you're talking about, where it's warm weather and people can be outside a lot more, is very different than being in this region, right, in the Northeast in the winter. So, because what we do know is that proximity indoors and air quality have a lot to do with transmission. So, I don't know the answer to that, Peter. And I think we are on track, right? I mean, we're saying by July 1, and the governor has opened everything up and so we're on our way. So let's hope that we're over the hump of it and that we can really get back to, the before days.
Well, let's hope that happens sooner rather than later. And we've had several people texting about getting people back to work as being the most important thing, that, we can get some normalcy back in our lives just doing it. And I think what the governor said is kind of a really mixed message. Yes, we're going to reopen as of this date, but by the way, stay 6 feet apart. And I don't know if you've done any investigation of the science behind that 6 feet. Do you know anything about that?
I don't. I mean,
well,
I.
You well, know. Let me tell you, okay?
Okay.
That was designed, a physician, I believe, came up with that in the 1870s, and basically a calculated guess. There was no study done. There was no science behind it whatsoever. The best science really is 3 feet, and that's modern day. And yet we've got all kinds of restrictions out there in society that the governor, for example, is maintaining right now in the days after we quote reopen, that are going to keep restaurants and entertainment venues almost impossible for them to make money. Do you talk about that at the partnership at all?
We do. We've talked a lot about how do we reopen those venues. But I will tell you, our board has been pretty consistent in saying that we have to follow the science, right? To your point, Peter, nobody knows. And I think if you were to plot Cuomo on a continuum, he's certainly been the most conservative around health policy as opposed to, let's say, the governor of Florida or Texas, on the opposite ends of the bell curve there. So I think the answer is probably somewhere in the middle. And I do see that, people are operating sort of with the best of intentions, and we have to see how it all shakes out. And I imagine, we will get back to some sense of normal, and there will be a lot more scientific documentation if, God forbid, we have another pandemic. But we're really sort of caught unawares as a country how to deal with something on this scale.
But my guest last week was Mike Shaman from Buffalo Place, and he used the term "follow the science" a couple times, and I questioned him about that, and I wonder what that really means. And I'm not sure any of us really know what that means, because science is
to us
it's a constantly evolving thing. There's a there's no such thing as the science. It's a series of really theories that are followed by some kind of verification process, et cetera. We do have to go to end the show here, Dottie. I've always enjoyed our conversations, and today's no exception. Thank you very much for being with us. Dottie Gallagher, president of the Buffalo Niagara Partnership. I'd like to thank all the listeners. We'll be back again next week at the same time. And remember, when it comes to real estate, all of upstate is hunt country.